It's 5:06. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Barrett.
Now we react to tragic events, to tragic events like the Washington Naval Yard shooting on Monday can run the gamut from agony to apathy.
Joining us now to talk about how people process emotions, why individuals react differently to tragedy, is Frank Farley, psychologist at Temple University, a former professor here in Wisconsin as well. Frank, thanks for being with us again.
Delighted to be here, Rob.
Well, you've watched a lot of these shootings in the United States, in Canada, and the reaction to them, the aftermath. What types of reactions are you observing in this week's shooting in Washington, D.C.?
Well, from what I can see, you're getting the full gamut. I've seen interviews with relatives and family of victims. There's three broad sort of categories of reaction. One is where you experienced it directly, so you might have been a victim and survived. The other one is you witnessed it. And the third category is you experienced it indirectly, that is, somebody told you about it. So, if we watch television or hear something on the radio describing it, that's that last category. You're experiencing it indirectly. But you can get a gamut of responses. There can be intense fear, helplessness. Some people will say, if only I was there, I could have made a difference. This helplessness, or just sheer terror, horror at what you've seen. So, for example, yesterday there was the bus that crashed into that was hit by a train up in Ottawa, Canada, and witnesses saw the bus driver decapitated in front of them, apparently. And one man was thrown out of the bus and was lying on the ground with both of his legs gone, etc. And so, just the sheer witnessing of these things can strike horror in people. So, again, there's the full gamut. Some of these things last a long time. Some of them can be so serious as to warrant the classification of PTSD. Other ones might simply be what we would call an acute stress disorder. And then other ones are just sort of passing. And, they'll disappear fairly quickly.
Well, it's always a challenge as someone in the media when there's some sort of tragedy and you wonder how much should you cover it? How much is too much? People want to know these things, but are you contributing to the stress of the people in that third category you talked about, the most of us who see things through the lens of the media? Does the way we cover things make people more fearful going forward in their lives?
That's a huge question because Some research suggests that it can make us more fearful. Others that it desensitizes us to violence. It's all over the place, and so it doesn't move us very much. And the final and really heinous category is where it might actually suggest something to someone to do a copycat. They see it, they see this event replayed, and for their own twisted reasons, they model it. They decide to do something like that themselves. So it can desensitize us, or it can make us afraid, or, again, the most heinous outcome might be it gives someone some ideas to do something similar.
These are outlier events. Happily, they're not things that happen each and every day. But given that We do more media coverage of them. As media consumers, we maybe seek out more media coverage of them. Do they loom larger in our minds than they really should?
Oh, I think they do. Yeah. And, I forgot to mention that wonderful old phrase about the media. If it bleeds, it leads. And, they do. What's happening is an isolated, unusual event. I mean, this thing at the Navy Yard is unusual. Against the backdrop of American life, but it gets enormous coverage. And so, yes, it's an exaggeration. And most people's lives will be entirely lived with no contact with such horror. And it's important to keep that in mind. The public has a right to know, of course, but do we need to constantly emphasize the destructive side of human nature? Does that in fact encourage or does it discourage comparable horror? And we don't really have good evidence on that, but, you know, there's no question that the dark side gets more press than the light side of human nature, typically in the news.
I've heard people make the case that you should step away from the coverage sometimes and pay attention to something else, read a book, look at some other news, entertainment news or something like that. Don't dwell, don't keep watching that Twitter feed for every last breaking detail. Is that a personal strategy that you might go for?
Yes, absolutely. You know, the old thing, emphasize the positive, that is so important. And, you know, you only have one life to lead. You want it to be happy, upbeat, positive. All this negative stuff, Zig Ziglar once referred to it as stinking thinking, all this negativity. And, you know, you've got to construct a happy life. And being upbeat and optimistic and positive is a lot better than focusing on the negative.
A healthier too, would you say?
Yes, definitely.
So for people closer to this, now not in that category where most of us are, we saw it from a distance, but people who were witnesses or victims, what kind of help is appropriate for them? I've seen debates back and forth. Do you need immediate talk therapy, or does that just kind of cement the images that you saw that day into your brain? What's the latest state of the art on that?
Well, for a long time, we believed that it was good to have that instant counseling. Now it's debatable. Again, there's not really comprehensive, valid data on this point. But it looks as if for some people, yeah, quick counseling is good, and for other people, it's not good. That is, it simply re-exposes them to the horror. And, you know, they're fighting with it, they're trying to get away from it. And so, personally, I lean toward less counseling rather than more, honestly. That is, you know, if you're going to be constantly dealing with it in the immediate aftermath, it's like you can't get away from this thing. On the other hand, the media is not going to let you get away from it anyway. So that would argue for some degree of counseling to help you separate yourself from this horror. So I think it's a, you know, 50-50, honestly. I think it depends a lot on the person and also the supports the person has in their life, the family supports and the friend supports. You know, if you've got lots of wonderful family and friend supports, maybe you need less of the professional support.
Let's talk about grieving a little. Obviously, people lost loved ones in this event, and people lose loved ones to less dramatic but still equally important events, car accidents, illness. Is there a right way to grieve? How do you talk somebody through that grieving process?
Well, you know, there's a variety of therapeutic approaches to grieving, but, you know, it's, again, very important to have social supports. Loved ones, family, friends. You know, there's growing data showing that loneliness and being, you know, alone in this life shows many of the same qualities as a disease. And there's a fellow named Cacioppo who's written a whole book on loneliness. And he makes a convincing case that, you know, dealing with everything yourself and all alone, et cetera, is extremely dangerous for your health. He claims it's like a disease. So, you know, a very important way, short of getting therapy, is friends and family, loved ones, and having that support system.
We're talking to Frank Farley. He's a psychologist at Temple University, about how we react to mass shootings, what it does to us when we see them in the media, what we think about them. Of course, linked to the shootings in Washington, D.C. on Monday. We want to hear from you. What was your reaction when you heard about the Naval Yard shooting? Are you worried we're becoming desensitized to events like this? Do you think we in the media spend too much time rehashing the events? Join the conversation at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or you can find our Facebook page and post there. That's Central Time on WPR.
You're listening to Central Time on Wisconsin Public Radio.
You're listening to Central Time, and we're back now with Frank Farley, psychologist at Temple University. We're taking your calls about reactions to the mass shootings Monday in Washington, D.C. How do you feel when you see news like this? Do you get obsessed? Do you watch the Twitter feed, watch the 24-hour news channels to get every detail, or do you step away for a bit? And how do you feel when you do either of those? 800-642-1234. 800-642-1234. Frank, before we go to the phones, I want to talk about the other side, the motivations behind shootings like this. I don't want to delve too deeply into this week's because obviously there's a lot we don't know yet. But I've talked to a criminal profiler in the past who says, you know what? These are rare enough. It's really hard to profile shootings like this with any accuracy. What do you think about that?
Oh, absolutely correct. About the only profile we have on rampage killers, mass murderers, etc., is that in general, they're males, they're white, they're between 20 and 40. In this case, Alexis fits the age criterion, the gender criterion, but he's an African-American. But, you know, there are literally millions of people who fit that category. So profiling in mass murders, serial killings, and rampage killings is really not is not scientific at this point. We just don't have much.
The sad part, then, is if it's hard to predict, how do we find people and maybe give them help they need, treatment, alternatives, things that keep them from doing something like this?
Well, I think that my own personal view, by the way, is that almost all of the perpetrators involved in those categories of murder have serious mental problems. Now, lots of people will cry out, yes, but most mentally ill don't kill people, and that is absolutely correct. But I happen to believe that most of these people who do these mass murders do have serious mental problems. So, you know, we just need to get better going forward in tracking, seriously problematic behavior. I mean, this guy is like a poster child for that. I really haven't seen a better case in a long time because there is actually a record. And of all of his serious encounters with authority, with police, his use of firearms under extremely difficult conditions, you know, or shooting at somebody's car or shooting at the apartment above his apartment, and a long litany of these things, and yet he was able to get a gun. Now, he got a shotgun. That's what he went into the naval yard with, and he picked up two other weapons while he was there. But, you know, and a shotgun, you know, is in sort of an everyday, you know, hunting weapon, et cetera, et cetera. But we've heard a lot about the red flags and what was missed, and I do believe a lot was missed, and this is a case to be thoroughly studied to see, is there an aggregation of problems that should then lead authorities to do something significant with a person.
But aren't there cases where somebody shows a lot of red flags and goes through their entire life without ever doing something like this?
Yes, that is exactly right. And we have this whole problem of false positives, et cetera. So we're a long way, you know. In his case, I mean, he seemed to have been paranoid. There's a couple of instances that would indicate that. He does not appear to have been getting any kind of treatment that has surfaced that I know of, at least treatment for his mental state. And he had all these acting out behaviors, this impulse control problem. His own father talked about his anger expression and anger management problems. But, you know, in a constitutional society like we have, it's very difficult to do much. And then you have those folk who say, well, if there was more armed people at the time, this would have never happened. And on it goes. So we don't have a lot of these, thank gosh. We don't have a lot of these kind of things. But this one in particular, I think, really needs some, as the UW Madison slogan goes, winnowing and sifting of the evidence, because this is we have more information about this guy than we've had about many of these, and we need to study it closely.
We've got full phone lines, people answering some of the questions we threw out there earlier. Let's go to Jane in River West. Jane, hi, you're on the air.
Hi, I have two brief comments. The first one is in response to the question about how the media, how I believe the media should handle it. And I believe that the best models are public television and radio, rather, because commercial television and radio are actually giving the public what they want, but unfortunately, with the 24/7 media frenzy, people are wanting all this moment-to-moment, be first, down to the grisly detail, lots of visuals. And in contrast, public media doesn't stop coverage of all other events practically, but maintains a balance, continues with the other big stories of the day, and does periodic updates. And I think that's a great, healthy balance for human beings.
Great. Thanks a lot for the call, Jane. Frank, a response to that?
Well, three cheers for public media.
I'll take it, yeah.
Absolutely. I love public media. But, you know, the commercial channels, et cetera, you know, we're not going to stop them from this kind of coverage. And their argument would be that the American people want it and they need it. I would just hope that they would become a bit more responsible in their reporting and throttle back a little bit on the negativity and, you know, produce some more positive images. I worry most about kids and kids who get exposed to all this stuff. You might remember in the aftermath of 9/11, I mean, I was advocating in the media that, you know, don't let your elementary school age kids see this stuff. You know, see that building going down and the screams and the people running. They don't need to know that. At an older age, yes, a limited amount of that, and discuss it and debate it and what it means to our society. And I would feel the same way for these sort of mass murders and et cetera. You know, like Sandy Hook shooting. I mean, we got a lot there. Thank gosh there was no video of it. But an awful lot of coverage, you know, that can scare the heck out of kids. So I think the commercial media does have to be a little bit more responsible and cut back a little bit on this coverage.
Jennifer writes on Facebook, there are so many mass shootings now, it made a small dent in my social media channels and in my immediate reaction. Whether that's burnout or what, I don't know. I keenly felt a lack of connection and empathy and horror that should have been evident immediately. It shames me, she writes, to say that, and yet it seems critical to acknowledge. Interesting reaction. What do you think, Fred?
Yeah. Well, she's sort of tuning into the numbing quality, you know, of the endless recounting of violence and horror in the media. And yes, some people do feel numbed and they don't respond. I mean, myself, I was driving down the main street in Philadelphia one day, and there was clearly a big police action going on. And I saw a policewoman running. She had a gun out and she was running, and other people were, and so on. And I mean, they weren't allowing you to stop, but I just sort of drove by and kind of looked at it and says, another, you know, criminal activity, and I went home. And so it's kind of easy to get numbed to this stuff.
We'll go to the phones again. Lori is with us in Stillwater, Minnesota. Lori, hi.
Hi. I wanted to make the point that when these situations come up, I think it's really easy for people to say, oh, it's another crazy, mentally ill person that has gone off with a gun. And for some of them, that is the case. But I think we all need to start asking the question of what kind of culture are we fostering here that brings about responses like this? It's happening more and more, and I would say that when you look around at how there's always money for wars and stadiums and, you know, bailing out big corporations and banks, but there's
Lori,
never
I'm gonna jump
money
in.
For schools.
I'm going to jump in because we don't have a lot of time left, but Frank, our culture fosters, it gives people maybe a script for a mass shooting as how you react to a situation. What do you think?
It could. It could. Sort of basically, crime has been going down a bit in the States, but not this kind of crime, not mass murders. And, maybe we are, you know, producing a script for more examples of this kind of thing, and therefore expect to see some more.
Just a quick, no time to go to the phones again, but Tim in Madison wonders, does the style of media coverage, how we cover these things, affect potential copycats? You were talking about copycats earlier, Frank. Briefly, is there a right way and a wrong way?
I don't think we know that. But if we had simply less lurid coverage, maybe that would, you know, downplay this for potential imitators. And we do know that some of people are looking for fame. That's sometimes a motive. And at least we could work on that by scaling back our coverage.
All right, Frank, thanks a lot for joining us. Always very interesting to talk to you.
You're welcome.
That's Frank Farley. He's a psychologist at Temple University, used to work here in Wisconsin, by the way, former president of the American Psychological Association.
Next is the news, and then we'll be back with a conversation on Wisconsin's controversial changes to estate tax.
You can always find out more about Central Time at the Central Time Facebook page. It's Central Time on WPR. And also, we're on that Twitter thing, Central Time WPR. Stick around. There's more to come here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Central Time on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Rob Ferris.
And I'm Veronica Rickard. Coming up on the show, we'll meet a captain of the Madeline Island Ferry. He'll talk about his work in our Hidden Wisconsin segment.
But first, let's take a look at some activity out of the State Joint Finance Committee this week. It made tweaks to the governor's estate recovery program.
It's a program that was expanded in the state budget, but members of the Joint Finance Committee raised concerns about the plan.
Here to help us sift through the changes and what this thing is Jason Stein, Capitol reporter for the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel. He's co-author of More Than They Bargained For, Scott Walker, Unions and the Fight for Wisconsin. Jason, welcome to Central Time.
Thank you, Rob.
Well, when we heard this news story here, we thought this needs a little more detangling, I think, to figure out what's going on. First of all, what is the estate recovery program?
I mean, this is something that the state has had for a period of time, prior to the Walker administration, that helps them recover the money that taxpayers pay, some of it, to put, you know, elderly people who can no longer care for themselves into nursing homes or give other long-term care. And what the Walker administration did essentially was to expand under state law the ability of government to go and recover those funds from the families of people who have been put into nursing home care under Medicaid.
And so Medicaid is paying for this long-term care. The idea is these families, in some cases, have assets that they could have been using instead of Medicaid. Is that what the concern is and why we have this law?
Right. So, correct. The state and federal taxpayers pay for long-term care for people in nursing homes through Medicaid. Now, obviously, those people, to qualify for Medicaid, you already need to be deemed needy by the rules that govern that program. But you know, nevertheless, there can be assets that a couple or an individual can have and retain when they go into the nursing home. And one example is a situation where you have a spouse who goes into a nursing home, passes away. You have the remaining husband or wife who, you know, continues to live for a period of time and then may also pass away and then leaves an estate. And so a lot of these rules look at, well, what rules come into play when that estate is divvied up and they decide, does the government get it? Do the heirs of the couple get it? Those are the kinds of questions that are being dealt with.
So it's not the case that, as you mentioned, when the first spouse in long-term care passes away, they go to the widow or widower and take the house away. That's not the goal of the program?
Right, right.
That would be unpopular, I think.
Right, right. I mean, it should be clear that the surviving widow or widower would still have some ability, you know, if they had not gone into a nursing home themselves, could still have some ability to keep some assets. But it is worth noting that if they remarry and then pass away, it may affect whether, you know, what their new husband and wife are able to retain in terms of assets and what might go to the state government.
And it also would affect what children would inherit in this instance.
Certainly,
right?
Yeah.
And that's probably the biggie, isn't
absolutely.
It?
Absolutely. Yes, absolutely. I mean, you know, the two edges of this are, you know, we do have this program at the state level that does, you know, give people the reassurance that their parents or grandparents are being, you know, taken care of. Even if their relatives are unable to do it. But the other side of that is that, yes, I mean, you know, for, say, a family, a farmer, and you know, goes into a nursing home and perhaps a son who's worked with him for his entire life may be hoping to inherit or even purchase the farm and continue to earn his or her livelihood from that property, you know, this could, you know, these new rules could certainly affect situations like that.
That's been part of the criticism that it might break up a farm or other small business entity.
Right. I mean, that would certainly be one of them. And that has been a criticism that has been leveled at it. The response has been that, you know, given the rising cost of health care, given and long-term care, given the fact that we will have more people needing that as the baby boomers age, the response is that if people have assets, have a means to pay for all or some of their care, that they need to be doing that.
And this has been in the news this week, as you mentioned. The program's been around for a while. They were tweaking it related to this marital property issue. Was this a really significant change, or is this a fine print sort of change, but that still would have gotten in the way?
Sure. The way this worked is the existing program to recover assets was changed by the state budget that passed at the end of June, and that was your big change. But lawmakers required the Walker administration to come back, and before those changes were implemented, they're already part of state law, but before they're implemented, to get the go-ahead from the legislature's budget committee. The committee largely gave that go-ahead yesterday while making some tweaks. One of the things that is really unusual is certain parts of the law yesterday the budget committee said would not be implemented, that the Walker administration could not implement them. But those areas, those statutes remain on the books. So you have this odd situation in which the laws cannot be enforced by the Walker administration or implemented by the Walker administration, but there are still the laws present. So there's a question then of what does that mean to, you know, private entities like banks and trusts and entities like that that help people who are, you know, transferring assets from one generation to another. What does that mean for them? Are they obligated to still follow the law, even though the state itself cannot? It's an unusual situation.
It's a twilight zone for a state
plan. It's a legal limbo. It certainly is.
And when is this something that when it's fully implemented, it means, okay, starting now and on into the future, this is in effect? Or is it somehow retroactive to people who would have applied to even before the law was passed? Or is that clear at this point?
I want to be careful here, Rob, because I just want to—I mean, I really should emphasize that if anyone has a specific situation that they need to look at, that probably the best thing for them to do is going to be, you know, seeking, you know, to reach out to both public agencies as well as private legal counsel that can help them, because these things are so complicated. You know, and that's probably where I had better leave that one.
Sure, sure. So this was not without controversy, mostly Republicans in favor of these changes, mostly Democrats opposed. Do I have that right?
Yeah, I think that's fair, although it's important to note that there were two Republicans who voted against moving forward with this change. It was Senator Sheila Harsdorf from River Falls and Senator Mary Lozich from New Berlin. And they both had concerns that what was passed by the budget committee yesterday still went too far, or that there were too many unanswered questions about it. So, you know, it would not be a huge surprise if the legislature comes back and revisits this, because there are some lawmakers on both sides of the aisle who are unhappy with it right now, and there are also, you know, some pretty significant state associations like the State Bankers Association that has voiced some very serious concerns about how this will play out for them, how much it will cost to, you know, implement the changes, and whether or not there's sufficient, the law is clear enough to allow them to do that.
Moving ahead, Joint Finance signed off on it. Does that mean, is that the go-ahead the Walker administration needs, or is this a thing where it goes through the committee and now the whole legislature has to pass it again, more or less?
No, I mean, it's certain. No, they can. The Walker administration can move forward with those parts of it that the Finance Committee approved yesterday. So, you know, the majority of the changes, to my understanding, will move forward. But, you know, I think both those changes, as well as the things that weren't approved yesterday, could be revisited, you know, in the coming months by lawmakers who want to see if they can improve the product.
Jason, thanks so much for helping us sort that out.
My pleasure, Rob. Thank you.
That's Jason Stein, Capitol reporter for the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel.
Coming up, it's the latest installment of our Hidden Wisconsin series, Meet a Man Who Keeps the Ferries Running in Bayfield.
You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.
It's time for another Hidden Wisconsin segment, where we take a peek at jobs people do in Wisconsin, things that we might take for granted.
In this installment, we take a trip from Bayfield to Madeline Island, and there's really only one way to do that, on the ferry.
Mike Radke is a U.S. Coast Guard licensed mariner, marine operations manager, and a longtime captain on the Madeline Island ferry line that runs between Madeline Island and Bayfield. Mike, welcome to Central Time.
Thank you. Pleased to be here.
Well, how did you get into the life of a Lake Superior ferry pilot?
Well, that's a now after, you know, being 56 years old, I have to think back and think, where did it all start? But it really started with my family falling in love with the Bayfield area back in the early 70s. And we had one of the first small sailboats in the Apostle Islands Marina when it was brand new. And I became a kind of avid sailor at the time, and that led me to want to kind of stay in the maritime field as a career. So, you know, one thing led to another, and here I am.
This is probably a pretty much a landlubber's question, but what exactly does the captain do?
Well, plenty. And, as you know, I'm a captain and a manager, so I've got to be careful that my crew, that I cover everything, because my crew would, you know, say, well, we do a lot more than that. But
sure.
Obviously we, you know, navigate the ferry back and forth between Bayfield and Madeline Island. But being that we operate a vehicle passenger ferry, we deal with lots of different types of loads of traffic from passengers, of course. But then we also deal with all the different types of vehicles that travel over the road. And we basically handle anything that can legally travel on the highway systems. And we've had, you know, we carry semis and cement trucks and everything you can imagine that has to get to a community pretty much travels with us. So it's a job with a lot of responsibility as far as, of course, passenger safety and then the loading and safe loading and unloading of the vessel, which is done basically every half hour when we are on our summer schedule.
Now, I've seen that summer schedule. It is a lot of back and forthing between Madeline Island and Bayfield. Does it get old going back and forth, or are you always just happy to be out there on Lake Superior?
Well, you know, I like in any job, I think there's a certain routine that you can't, you know, that probably at times you wish you didn't have to deal with. But, you know, every day is different. The weather is different. Customers are different. The loads. So those add challenges and interest. I think our crew has a pretty good relationship with each other, and they, you know, enjoy their work. So going to work with the people you enjoy being with is not such a burden. And, you know, I had somebody ask me that same question once, and I said, well, I'm sure orthopedic surgeons some days just go in and say, I just don't want to have to repair that knee. You know, I'm tired of doing knees today. So we all have our routines and our jobs, and we learn how to, you know, get through them. But overall, I think, you know, we're on just an incredible piece of a big lake. You know, it's just an amazing place with beautiful sunrises and sunsets and changing weather. So there's plenty to see, and I think that that's what kind of keeps us going.
Well, Lake Superior is pretty famous for being temperamental, especially, you know, in the autumn storms before it freezes over. Have you ever been on a ferry ride when the weather's kind of rough?
Well, I have, and certainly all of our captains have. You know, I kind of downplay that a little because I think Lake Superior sometimes gets an undeserved reputation. Of course, everybody knows about the Edmund Fitzgerald.
It's Gordon Lightfoot's problem.
Yeah.
It's that song.
Exactly. But, you know, the majority of the time, the lake is not that rough. But certainly in the fall is when we do get the roughest conditions. And those are challenging times. It's just something you know you have to deal with, and you know, we take safety pretty very seriously in our company, and there are times when we just say, you know, it's just too difficult conditions, and we're going to shut down for a period of time. Usually it's just a matter of shutting down for a few hours and letting things settle down, but there have been those occasional times where we've actually shut down for the majority of the day. The challenge is not so much actually being on the water, it's actually coming in for a landing. It's kind of like pilots on a plane, you know, once they're in the air, that's not the most difficult time. It's when they're landing and taking off, and so that's the same for our captains. They have the challenge of coming into a basically up against something that's hard with a very large vessel and doing it safely in conditions where there's a lot of wind and wave action. So that's what kind of forces our decision to, you know, reduce our schedule or shut down service if we have to.
Now, you mentioned the Edmund Fitzgerald, the ship that went down famously. But, you know, besides that, there's a lot of history that's gone on in Lake Superior. It's a pretty historic place where you live there. Are you aware of that as you go back and forth, that you're just part of this chain of maritime history that's gone on for a long time?
Well, we are. In fact, in our terminal building in Bayfield, we have kind of a very nice display of photographs of the kind of original ferries that first plied the water here. And, you know, interestingly, the ferries certainly went back and forth between Bayfield and Madeline Island, first just carrying passengers. And the first ones, of course, were sailboats, and, of course, before that, with the Native Americans and their canoes. But then the ferries actually played an important role in the development of the communities along the Shawamigan shoreline from Bayfield to Washburn to Ashland, because the road systems weren't there and the railroad really wasn't in. It was really the ferries that provided transportation between those communities and played an important role in their development. And then eventually the railroad came in, and then finally when vehicles became popular, the road system.
Well, tell us a little bit about, you know, what the 9 to 5 is like on your job, or maybe it's not 9 to 5. I know the ferry runs pretty late, but what is it like when you get up in the morning? If I wanted to be a captain on the Madeline Island Ferry, what would my life be like?
Well, first I'd like to say you're right. It's not a 9 to 5 job. I was on a boat this morning, actually, and I was there at 5:30. That meant I got up at 4:30. And so it's probably like being the host of a morning show on Wisconsin Public Radio.
So you're the Joy Cardine of Lake Superior.
Yeah, exactly. And so, you know, you get up early, you go in, and you start getting the vessel ready for the day, which means a pretty thorough checkout of engines and systems on board. And then we make our first trip at 6:30 in the morning. And we carry commuters and workers who are going over. Usually the people that are going over that early are people that have to go to the island for a job or for some work of some sort. When we get to the island at 7 o'clock, the people we're bringing are commuters that are going to the mainland for work, and also the school kids who live on the island. From 6th grade on, they ride the ferry to Bayfield to attend school in Bayfield. So they're our precious cargo, I guess, at 7 in the morning.
Yeah.
And then from then on, it's you know, it's a variety of commuters and then visitors to the area who are going back and forth.
And what time does your day end?
Well, it depends on the time of the year, but it can end, like if it's a morning shift, for instance, your day would end somewhere around 2:30 in the afternoon. If you work a night shift, you could start up at 2:30 and work as late as midnight, and then Friday and Saturday nights you could work as late as 1 in the morning. So, again, there's these great opportunities for sunrises and sunsets, but it's not an easy, you know, it's not an easy thing. Shift work is hard work and demanding, but our crew does a good job of balancing that out in their lives.
How important would you say the ferry is as a lifeline for the people who live on Madeline Island?
You know, it's extremely important. And when you talked about the weather and shutting down for weather, of course, that's always a difficult decision for us because we understand how important it is for people to get to their jobs, for the kids to get to school. So we don't take it lightly as to, you know, making that decision. And yet, of course, safety is the most important consideration. But it is a lifeline. We carry all of the materials, the things that people need, from food to fuel oil, to propane, gasoline, and all the other things that are needed, and then, of course, the passengers. So, and you know, when it really becomes kind of the thing that, that people most connect with, it's those people who live year-round on the island that have, you know, really depend on us, especially in the winter months and in the, you know, kind of the waning parts of our season. And our schedule gets quite reduced by then. We still run about 17 round trips a day, but it's not, we're not running as late into the night. And we... You know, we don't take for granted how important that is for those people who live there year-round to have that service and to have a, have, you know, enough frequent trips so that they can do their job and to do the things that they need to do, getting to doctor's appointments, those types of things.
I've only got about 30 seconds left, but what's your favorite season to be out on the water?
Wow, that's a tough one. You know, I love fall. I mean, it's really amazing to be here in the fall and to watch the colors change. And every day you're out there and you look at the hillsides of Bayfield and out among the islands and see those colors changing. It's just a constantly changing palette. So it's hard to hard to say that fall isn't my favorite time.
Yeah, right about now. So I hope you're having a good run of it.
Well, it's starting. It's late this year because of the kind of late start to summer. So the colors haven't really gotten, but I'm sure that around Apple Festival and maybe the week after, we're going to have some pretty spectacular color.
All right. Well, Mike, thank you so much for joining us. It's been a pleasure.
Thank you. It's been a pleasure for me as well.
That was Mike Radke. He's Marine Operations Manager and longtime captain on the Madeline Island Ferry Line that runs between Madeline Island and Bayfield.
If you want to be on Hidden Wisconsin or suggest someone, call our hotline, 855-683-5422. That's 855-683-5422.
Or post on our Facebook page at Central Time on Wisconsin Public Radio.